I don't know. Then you can go up to the Good afternoon. Can everyone hear me okay? Everybody in the back? Guys in the front, we're not going to accept heckling from them. Good afternoon. My name is James Price. This is Jeffrey Slapp. We work for Fairway Consulting Group. We're a VAC partner based down in Florida. This afternoon, we're going to talk all about virtualized storage. For everyone that has come here today and is familiar with VMware and seeing the phenomenal growth in the market in the virtualization space and compute, the premise of what we're here to talk about this afternoon is extending that same paradigm into storage. All the value, all the great things that we love about virtualization and the compute platform, virtualized storage and that virtualization paradigm extension holds the same thing here. This session is predominantly intended for virtual infrastructure architects, for the people that are out there every day in the trenches who are focused on maximizing their overall storage system capabilities. One of the many challenges that we face in the market today is the tremendous acquisition rate of applications and in storage inside the data center. How many people need less storage today than you did 6 months ago? Anybody? I didn't think so. That's the problem that everyone faces today. We need more storage. We need it to go farther. We need it to be faster. The faster we virtualize, the faster the virtualization platform becomes, the faster the I/O pathing and the underlying storage needs to be to accommodate that. So what we're going to talk about is, what is storage virtualization, and specifically its role as it relates to working with VMware? Some of the advantages and features of storage virtualization, specifically around hardware independence, which is a kind of a key in storage virtualization, increasing storage utilization, taking a look at how storage is aggregated today, what percentage of utilization you have today, and how we can better leverage that in a virtualized storage environment. And then some stuff about investment protection and so on. ESX under storage virtualization architecture. Some interesting things that come out of the marrying of those two technologies together and extending that paradigm. And then we're going to talk about some best practices in virtual environments, some notes from the field. We deploy a significant number of solutions today based on a combination of virtualized compute resources and virtualized storage, and going to lend some of the things, I guess you would say, notes from the field. And then we'll wrap it up and we'll have some questions at the end, hopefully. So what is storage virtualization? What do we mean when we say storage virtualization? Anybody, what's storage virtualization mean? If I said to you today, in 10 words or less, what is storage virtualization to you? So storage virtualization is the concept of storage abstraction. This is the same idea that we think about when you think about the hypervisor today. So the analogy that I like to use is, if you abstract storage in the same way you abstract hardware and compute, it goes a long way. This abstraction takes the form of a virtual disk LUN being presented to a virtual server host. The virtual disk LUN is simply an abstraction of the real physical storage being managed by the virtualization controller. Virtualization controller is specifically the intelligence within, and in this case, data core, specifically their storage domain servers that provide core services to manage that storage abstraction layer. Okay, now, and if we're going to talk about some very simple architectures to begin with, and then we're going to extend that out into a more common enterprise environment that you're likely to see in a data center. On the client side of the SDS presents a virtual LUN to the virtual server host, which is the initiator, for those who are not intimately familiar with storage and how it works. The guy asking for the storage is always the initiator, and the guy giving it up is always the target. The virtual disk LUN can be any size up to 2 terabytes. The upper limit, which is in fact the upper limit for ESX. Storage initiator side of the SDS consumes the actual physical storage presented by the devices and aggregates that storage into pools that you can define based on your organization's need. And this is going to become key as we talk more about how you actually put together a virtualized storage infrastructure. So here's a basic basic storage configuration diagram. These devices can be any kind of storage. That can be direct attached storage. That can be SATA-based storage. That can be fiber channel storage. That could be iSCSI-based storage. It can be an intelligent array. So it can be an existing storage platform that you have that you want to extend into a heterogeneous storage environment. So, in this case, the zoning takes place in the same fashion that we've always done it, except that instead of zoning the actual host directly to the storage controller, we're zoning it directly into the virtualization controller. And then on the back side, we take whatever our physical actual storage is, and we zone that instead to the virtualization controller. So your virtualization controller sits in the middle and allows you to create pools. So now, if this were a high-speed fiber channel SCSI-based storage, I could potentially have my top tier of storage. These two may be a combination SATA fiber channel storage that represent a more traditional mirrored tier storage. And this could be some other lower end storage that would be more appropriate for tier 3 archival based storage. So what are some of the major advantages of storage virtualization? Hardware independence. Every one of those boxes can be from another vendor. You're no longer tied in a virtualized environment. So you think about a DRS cluster. How many people have used DRS today? Or at least experimented with it in some form or fashion? Okay, in a virtualized storage environment, what we're doing is essentially providing the same type of thing where you can aggregate heterogeneous devices inside a cluster. So I may have, in a DRS cluster, I may have a four-way box and I may have a two-way box. In storage virtualization, I may have an appliance from one vendor, an appliance from another vendor, and then I may have a low-end device that I'm using for a lower-end tier of storage. All of that aggregated behind an intelligent virtualization array. With these heterogeneous storage devices, the SDS is a storage-specific software package that runs on Windows-based hosts. Therefore, any storage device that a Windows operating system can see, you can use. I would say that you could probably chain together a lot of USB drives and get away with it, but I wouldn't try it. Logical Disk Manager in Windows is what actually sees it, and then from there the storage virtualization software takes over. This feature gives storage administrators an almost unlimited number of options in designing your storage environment to support the actual business needs of your environment. Simplifying storage administration. An SDS provides a virtual LAN up to 2 terabytes in size. Not that many operating systems will allow you to create disks much bigger than that. This virtual size will not be fully utilized by most servers. In ESX, 2 terabyte LANs are not that common. And really, 64 terabytes is the absolute maximum of a single VMFS volume inside ESX3, and that's achieved only by spanning 2 terabyte LANs together to aggregate that size. As a result, by doing this, because the storage is virtualized, and we're going to talk about how we actually do the virtualization in a second, there's no real practical penalty. Today, in a standardized storage array, when you take a disk group and you carve up LANs off of that group, that storage is effectively committed. In a virtualized environment, that's not the case. How much storage you physically have behind that really doesn't matter that much because you're allowed to virtualize that and present that forward as you go. Question? The storage requests are not handled by Windows. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in detail. The same mechanism of caching that you have here is the same type idea behind it from an architectural perspective as you would have in a conventional array. I mean, if you take the cover off your storage processor, what kind of circuit board sits underneath it? There's RAM there, there's a processor there. It's the same idea. The only difference is in a virtualized storage model with the heterogeneous platform support, that can now be modern hardware that you can upgrade on the fly. You can field upgrade to a faster platform if you find that you need that. And when we talk about where we get the memory to compile disk cache, we're going to have some key advantages there. So major advantages of storage virtualization: significantly higher storage volume utilization. So as you present these virtual volumes into your virtual host, into your ESX host, they're not actually writing that data out. If you create a VMDK today and it's a 10 gig monolithic file and you install Linux as a base operating system, how much of that actual 10 gigs is data? a couple of gigs on the outside. But on a traditional storage array, you've laid out a 10 gig monolithic file and consumed 10 gigs of storage. In a virtualized storage environment, you're not. You're only actually writing out the actual data that is there. Nothing else. The host on this side, sees that as a monolithic file, as though it were really there.
Quick question. At what point do you need to actually create another fabric? At what point do you actually have so many servers to saturate the fabric and putting another set of nodes on another set of fabric into another set of storage?
That's going to be measured essentially by the amount of I.O. that you're generating. I mean, you're going to have to take a look at your total fabric design, the number of hosts, the aggregate amount of I.O. per channel that you're generating. You know, can your switches do it? When we get to one of the other diagrams, we're going to show an ISL link. One of the most common flaws in basic fabric design today is that the ISL link that interconnects your switches is essentially running at the same speed of every other port. So if you have to transit that ISL link for a whole lot of stuff, that represents a core fabric design bottleneck. Okay. Caching. So how are we able to deliver with this virtualized that layer of abstraction the same degree of performance and ideally better performance than we get off of a traditional storage environment? It's by implementing high-speed cache. Today, When a storage product is designed, a typical development life cycle runs somewhere between 27 and 36 months. So when a hardware appliance is delivered, you're getting something that's probably somewhere between 2 and 3 years old the day it arrives. By leveraging commodity-based systems, you can buy the latest hardware. How much faster is the CPU today than it was 3 years ago? How much faster is the memory bus? How much more memory can you place in a device today than you could 3 years ago? By running in a virtualized environment, you can now upgrade your virtualization and your storage controllers on the fly as hardware moves forward. You can also supplant that with vendors as you do a refresh cycle. So if you change vendors as you go, you have the flexibility now to change. 80% of all the memory that's inside an SDS can be consumed as disk cache. 80%.
How do you upgrade your SDS?
You simply bring your new hardware platform in, install the virtualization software package, and then move the volumes over to the new platform.
But is it an HA configuration?
Yes.
Do you do a rolling upgrade?
Yes.
How do you handle patch management for Windows? If it's Windows-based?
Well, I wouldn't put it on the network where it is exposed to a high degree of security risk, but in an HA environment, you could conceivably patch it in the same way you would anything else.
And is it locked down? Securely locked down?
Yes, you can. Again, I mean, I wouldn't advocate putting it on a regular production network for obvious security reasons, but absolutely it's supported for full lockdown. None of the communication, other than configuration information that's exchanged between nodes, it ever goes over anything on Ethernet, unless you're running, of course, you're talking about iSCSI.
Is all the hardening that you do to make a Windows box, I don't want to say a Windows box secure, but as secure as it possibly can be, is that done by the SDS software when it's installed?
No, it is not. You have to do it. You can use your own security policy templates. You can use the Windows Security Configuration Wizard, any of the normal things that you would traditionally do to lock down a box. So if you take an average x86, x64-based system today, you have 4 gigs of RAM in it, you immediately have 3.2 gigs of high-speed, current-generation memory with full bus speed available as disk I.O. cache. The amount of cache that you can have is limited only by the platform that you choose.
Is that write cache or refresh?
Both. What happens if your RAM fails in anything? Sure. Same thing applies here. If you're running in a highly available configuration, then you're going to have cache consistency between multiple nodes. Okay. Simplified storage expansion. Again, when I asked earlier when we started, how many people need less storage today than they did 6 months ago? Nobody raised their hand. Everybody needs more. The ability to add more storage on the fly. When true backend physical storage reaches 85%, which is the default setting in the software, it notifies you that you've virtualized to the point where you really need to start adding more physical disk behind there. The SDS administrator need only connect additional storage to the fabric or in a non-fabric-based environment directly to it. Design a new pool, you can add more storage to the pool, or you can create new pools. Again, the idea here is that today I start off with probably mid-tier type storage. Think about a SATA fiber back-ended SATA array, and I put, say, 16 terabytes inside that. As I grow my virtual environment and the IO aggregated IO coming out of my ESX farm grows, I may need to move that into a higher tier one level platform. So now I may introduce all fiber channel based drives and fiber channel based arrays into my storage virtualization controller. As I do that, I can create a new pool that represents that pool of high speed storage. I can mirror my volumes over while my VMs are running, and I have now effectively migrated from mid tier storage to tier one storage with zero downtime. And now I've recouped the capacity from my mid-tier storage that I can reuse into another pool. Unparalleled storage system redundancy. One of the unique advantages of storage virtualization is we're not limited to mirroring in the convention of twos. By default, you can support tertiary mirroring, so you can have three copies of every volume that are all active-active. In addition to that, you can have up to 8 nodes of virtualized storage controllers inside the fabric to distribute your workload across. So 3 copies of every volume, 8 nodes in the fabric, all caching independently, all active-active. How much I.O. can you handle? How much I.O. can you generate? The flexibility and the growth there is one of the keys. And again, for your tertiary volumes, maybe you elect not architecturally to expose all of them to production-facing I.O. Perhaps your tertiary mirrors represent volumes that you use on mid-tier storage for backup. Maybe those are part of your plan that allow you to do rolling upgrades and migrations. The idea behind virtualized storage, much like VMware, is allow you the flexibility to architect and design systems that are highly available and high performance. Additional advanced SAN features, auto-provisioning. What this really is DataCore's way of virtualizing that storage. It allows you to create these virtual volumes that are abstracted from the physical storage. As data is coalesced and marked for destage, the SDS actually allocates 128 megabyte blocks, storage allocation units on your back-end storage device. That's the increment by which actual physical storage is consumed on the back-end. Snapshot. Point-in-time snapshots generated using copy-on-write. It's very industry standard. Everyone does it. The difference is when you take a snapshot, the snapshot doesn't actually have to consume the full amount of volumes worth of data. What's actually there is only what you're changing. So again, as you're virtualizing that storage, your copy-on-write is only consuming data as you cross chunks, and each chunk comes across the 128 meg boundary. So now you actually have the ability to maintain a number of snapshots online concurrently. Multi-protocol storage support. This is becoming all the rage in storage today. Allows the ability to support iSCSI and fiber channel mapping of virtual volumes to application servers. ESX today supports seeing volumes over both iSCSI and fiber channel. In multipathing in ESX today, the only limitation is all paths for a volume must be on the same, within a given host, have to be over the same technology. So if I take a very simplistic two-path, multi-path access to a given LUN within a host, both of those have to, it either has to be iSCSI based or it has to be fiber channel. We can't have one leg on either one. However, with multi-protocol storage support, it allows you to have some servers that are accessing that LUN over iSCSI, and some servers that see the same one over fiber channel. So what that effectively means is I'm a vMotion away from changing storage, transport, and protocols, and thereby upgrading on the fly from across tiers of storage. High availability synchronous mirroring, also called auto failover. Synchronous mirroring duplicates all I/O to the participating SDSs. And when I talked about tertiary mirroring, this is where it starts to get a lot pretty fun. This provides multiple redundant mirror copies, up to 3 copies of each mirror, in the event of failure. Not only are the I/O paths redundant, the data is redundant, because every node uses independent storage. Unlike traditional storage arrays, you actually have that many copies of the data. So if I have different cabinets, different frames physically separated, even inside the same data center, we're going to talk about long-range replication in a minute, different PDUs, different paths, I have multiple copies of the same data. Very, very, very high availability architecture. All LUNs are available down all paths for read-write simultaneously. In a tertiary mirror configuration, you can lose 66% of your storage architecture at one time and not lose access to your data. Not that many people can sustain that level of failure without losing, without affecting application server access to the storage target. All SDS mirror partners may actively process I/O with one handling primary paths and others handling secondary paths. Asynchronous IP mirror. This is long-range replication. It's disk block replication over standard IP. And there are just too many features about that for us to go into right here. ESX in a virtualized storage architecture is not treated any differently than any other kind of host, be it Windows, Solaris, Linux, doesn't matter. However, ESX, for everyone who's worked with it for a while, knows that ESX's native multipath driver is not the smartest thing out there. It's pretty much a lights on, lights off type driver. So, to compensate for that, one of the features in this virtualized storage architecture is in the event of a failure, be it a back-end storage failure or whatever, we turn the light off. By doing that, ESX immediately recognizes the failure. And instead of waiting for the traditional timeout and path reselection and polling, ESX will immediately move to another path. So you have zero I/O loss, zero delay in your environment. This is key for high availability, for clustering and stuff inside VI3. Because of the true active-active nature and tertiary mirroring of SDSs, it is entirely possible and strongly recommended to balance your I/O over multiple channels. So if you have a cluster of ESX hosts, you want to distribute those not only over the HBAs on the actual hosts themselves, but actually distribute that workload over the copies of the mirror that are out on your fabric. By doing so, you're actually leveraging 2 to 3 times the amount of cache, because the caching mechanisms are now independently evaluating your read and write I/O against the individual host on the individual LUN that's actually talking to it. Does that answer your question a little bit better about cache? Best practice when deploying in virtual environments. Each SDS should utilize MPIO for the storage-facing side to provide SDS storage path redundancy. Never have an ESX server have only one leg going to its storage platform. Fiber channel switches should be cross-connected in full fabric mode. Strongly recommend ISL trunking. You might as well do it. If you have multiple switches, you might as well leverage that. One caution about this. Be careful with your switch vendors. Make sure you're fully aware of the limitations in ISL trunking and fiber channel. More often than not, the trunk uplinks are the same speed as the ports. So walk through a couple of scenarios of failover. Make sure you fully understand the path ramifications of using ISL. It is very, very easy, again, to aggregate that load coming across this trunk to create a bottleneck inside your fabric. Each node of the storage environment should be in a separate rack space, leverage separate PDUs, separate connectivity. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Spread it out. Thorough data center planning. Thorough data center policies and procedures. Long-range replication. One of the nice things is, in a virtualized storage environment, as we've said, heterogeneity support. It doesn't have to be the same on the far side. It doesn't have to be tier one storage over there just because it is in the main data center. It can be mid-tier, it could be low-end.
On your previous slide, can you put that in the highest credit configuration versus fiber channel?
Yeah, go back one.
Could you put that in the highest credit configuration?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, iSCSI multipathing is handled obviously significantly different, but the same thing applies. I mean, and one of the nice things is, of course, is I mean, you can leverage some hardware iSCSI stuff in addition to leveraging software iSCSI. And the multipathing, again, is going to be a little bit different depending on which way you're doing iSCSI. So it doesn't have to be the same on the remote side. So this could be tier one. This could be mid-tier. This could be mid-tier. This could be low-end stuff. Hey, the business is still running. You're still making money. It's a little bit slower, but it's better than nothing at all. Choose a WAN link that's adequate to carry the block level change to the remote site. Well, how do we figure out what the right level of connectivity is to replicate that data? If I have 10 terabytes, how big does my WAN link need to be? Well, unfortunately, I don't have a silver bullet to tell you that. There's a variety of things that are going to factor into that conversation, not the least of which is rate of change, aggregate data, the actual throughput rate that you're going to see over that, WAN overhead, whether or not you're using acceleration compression devices, how you're managing security encryption over that link. There's a lot of things that come into play. Ensure that the remote site network is logically similar to the production network to guarantee that the switchover is seamless. And what we're talking about here is if you're using like VMware HA or something like that to do very simplistic VM failover across from one data center to the another. If you're using some other more advanced software, guys that never fail, PlateSpan and some of the other technologies that hopefully everyone has seen while you were here this week, they have some other advanced functionality that built in to allow you to have a server represent itself with a different network ID. However, this storage here, if you power VM up on an ESX host over here, and he was running over here, he's going to be exactly the same. Exactly the same, because what's here is, in fact, what's here. Every block that's transferred across is persistent. So at any moment, you can power on the other side.
What kind of delay or lag time in between is it? At the point in time, or is there any kind of lag time?
You can insert snapshot markers for exact point in time that'll be streamed across the link. How far your delay is again going to be a factor of your rate of change, the actual amount of data, and the WAN link itself. And the software will actually display for you that you're X number of minutes, so many chunks out of sync. I mean, that's going to be something you're going to kind of have to fill out a little bit because it's different for every single implementation. Question?
So is there a way that you can set it up so it does emerge on the fly and it basically figures out I'm so much behind when I brought the machine up? You know, get the two of them together, figure out the time and space and changes, sync them together so whatever amount of time, you're eventually back to the present. You know what I mean?
If you put a snapshot marker in there periodically, then you'll have a perfect point in time. If you don't, you're going to be there. How far, you're going to have to understand based on your change rate.
But there's no merging functionality such that it takes the changes that happen after boot and the changes that happen prior to the synchronization being complete and merge them. So, you know what I'm saying? Because now you have an intermediary that sits between the disk and itself, and that could actually handle the merge while the machine is actually running.
No, because there are some issues around maintaining consistency in that. If I have a change here,
why even allow you to go back there and snap up one time?
No, I mean you can go to the last block that was streamed in. it may not be a perfect, you know, point in time. It may be a power consistent point in time, and there is a distinct difference between the two. But yeah, it gets a little trickier if you power on this side and then you subsequently power back on this side, and how you sever the two and how you would remerge them. That's a little bit longer out of school conversation. It can be done, but it's a little more tricky. Okay. Some other best practices. Virtualizing the storage makes it very, very easy to use more and more RDMs. The reason that RDMs are kind of nice is because it allows you to do some magic that you otherwise can't necessarily do. Or you have to rely on VMware and some of the things that they do. In a virtual storage environment, it is entirely possible to present all VMs with RDMs. The advantage is every virtual disk and every VM could essentially be 2 terabytes. Not necessarily saying that I would do it that way. I'm just saying that it becomes now practically possible to do it because the committed storage penalty is now removed. It costs you no more to give every VM a 2 terabyte LUN than it does to give it a 20 gig LUN. There's no committed storage penalty in virtualized storage. Another scenario to consider is that by doing RDMs, it opens the door to leveraging SAN-based snapshots. While snapshot functionality inside VMware is incredible, it is not exactly the same, and it has some unique properties in both how it's manipulated and what you can do with the data in the meantime. However, SAN-based snapshotting is old school. Everybody knows how to do it. There's a ton of ways to get it done, and you're limited pretty much almost by your storage imagination with what you can do with it. Because there's no storage committed storage penalty, using RDMs and leveraging this functionality brings a lot more to the table now than it ever has before.
How do you handle an exchange or SQL delivery for consistent snap? In other words, are you just powering off the machine?
No.
When you do a snap?
Well, you have a couple ways to do it. I mean,
you pull out the database.
You can, absolutely. You can do one of two ways. There, if you're talking about Windows specifically and Exchange or SQL Server specifically, one of those two, absolutely. There are agents. You can call the VSS writer inside of Windows to momentarily quest the I.O., place a slipstream marker in the file cache, flush cache the disk, take snapshot, and continue. Or, as all modern operating systems are fundamentally power consistent, you can snap it and go. Depends on how bold you are, I suppose, some might say. Okay. If you use traditional VMFS, this is actually kind of cool. Because you can give ESX a 2 terabyte LUN. You never have to worry about spanning. You never have to worry about anything else. Because it doesn't matter how much you actually put there. The only storage commitment is the actual amount of data. So if I take a 2 terabyte virtual volume that's presented to ESX, it's formatted in VMFS 3.2.1, and I drop 10 VMs on there that are 10 virtual disks apiece. I install a very, very basic Windows 2003 Enterprise Edition server image on there. I have used all of about 16 gigs of space, 20 gigs of space. That's it. Because that's all the amount of actual data that was put out there. I didn't burn the 100 gigs of space of monolithic VMDKs that VMware thought that it wrote out there.
Can you draw that LUN on the fly to make it seamless to the
host? No. But you can't grow it because you can't grow VMFS today. VMware doesn't natively support extending VMFS volumes. They don't really like that too much. Avoid using SAN-based snapshots on VMFS with running VMs. If you do that, VMware's not going to be happy with you. And if you do it, certainly do not present the snapshot back to the original host. There are some real issues around doing that. Talk to support, they'll tell you that's a no-no. Long story short, it's a multi-access file system. You theoretically would have lots and lots of hosts talking to that LUN at one time. There's no underlying file cache flush mechanism to coordinate all of that flush at one time to take a clean snap. So while you can take a snap, the results you get may vary. Rely on VMware-based snapshot provider. If you're using VMDKs, you're running on VMFS, VMware has an excellent snapshot provider. I strongly recommend that you use that. DataCore-powered storage virtualization provides a lot of features, not the least of which, heterogeneous storage hardware flexibility. Anything that you can run Windows 2000 and higher on is pretty much eligible. Doesn't have to be super fast, very, very thin layer. Storage virtualization as it's implemented there, very much like the hypervisor model inside of ESX, except for storage. Simplified storage administration. Create pools, very simple to create tiered storage pools, aggregate storage, expand storage on the fly, move storage around in the background, completely unknown and unaffected to all of your guests and your hosts. Significantly higher ROI due to higher storage utilization. You're only actually burning the real storage that you need. Only the actual data is written out. Higher overall storage performance due to large high-performance cache and greater flexibility in load balancing. You have the ability, when we're talking about RDMs, one of the other advantages of RDMs kind of plays into this. Load balancing in ESX is on a per-LUN basis. If I have a few large or moderately sized LUNs attached to a host, that and that alone is the granularity with which I can balance I.O. As everyone knows, ESX today does not support dynamic multipath load balancing. Load balancing is wholly a manual function that you as a storage administrator and or as an ESX administrator will perform. By using more RDMs and LUNs, that allows you the flexibility on an order of magnitude to increase the granularity with which you can perform load balancing. Extended storage system lifecycle due to the modularity of the storage system. When you're tired of the server you have, you've outgrown the server you have is ready to go through server refresh, it's a very simple process to node by node do a rolling upgrade on your hardware. You're no longer tied to that platform. You're not dropping hundreds, tens, hundreds, thousands of dollars into a hardware platform that you're stuck with and you have a fixed lifecycle on. Now when you're done, it's software. Software is transportable. You can take it with you to your next generation of hardware. Full end-to-end redundancy capabilities all the way down to the data, because that's really what we care about. We're here because we care about data. Multiple copies of the data, not mirrors in the same frame. Not just a remotely replicated mirror 1,000 miles away. Multiple copies inside your data center that allows you an extraordinary capacity for failure without jeopardizing or limiting access or performance. Enterprise SAN features at a reasonable cost point. Storage virtualization carries with it the same economies of scale as VMware does. How many virtual servers can you put in a single physical platform with VMware? How much more storage can you represent in a storage virtualization platform? It's the same idea. Questions?
Are your storage resource pools capacity bound, or do you oversubscribe your hardware to the certain
extent? You absolutely have the ability to oversubscribe your hardware. The idea is that you want to oversubscribe your hardware because now you don't suffer the commit penalty. So there's no reason why I don't present multiple logical virtual boundaries of storage, and then in the background, the virtualization software, just like VMware is kind of telling you when your resource pool is being tapped out, same thing. The storage virtualization software is going to say, hey, you need to start adding some physical disk because you've basically consumed that percentage of your physical capacity.
What happens in the case when you get an exhaustion with your...
You're not going to be able to write anymore. It's not a deal killer. You're just not going to be able to write anymore. The disk is full. There's nothing else there.
How do you recover?
Add more. Just put more disk in. And it'll extend out.
Well,
if I filled my C drive, the same thing would happen.
The operating system knows that it can't write anymore, whereas in in that virtual context, if it thinks that it has more capacity, it can go subscribe.
Right. But the actual effect will be exactly the same. It'll suddenly, you'll be just like you ran out. If you had a, you know, straight up volume and you ran out of size, it's going to treat it the same way.
Won't it actually alert you?
That's what I'm saying. It's 75 or 85% by default. It's going to start saying, hey, I need more. I need more. Now, if you're asleep, you know, the software can't help you. The gentleman in the back? Nope. Everything's over the fabric. And it's about 20 microseconds. You're only going to have a three-way check. Because you're only at max, you're going to have tertiary mirroring. You may have eight nodes. You only have three copies of a mirror. So you're only going to touch at any given time three out of the eight. And that's presumably if you had, to keep the model simple, we say you have three ESX hosts. You may have eight nodes in your fabric that are performing caching, but you only have tertiary mirroring. So each host could talk to one of each of the three copies of the mirror. So your cache consistency there is only going to be 20 between. No. I can have three virtual volumes. Each virtual volume can have three, could have a tertiary mirror, three copies of each virtual volume. So I can distribute that out fully across all of the nodes in my fabric, giving me the maximum opportunity to leverage my cache inside the fabric.
Does that say that a particular one can only be accessed through one?
No, I can access
at a time.
No, I can access it through three at a time. Yeah.
But is it, say this one is not mirrored across three. So you only have one representation of it. Maybe you don't want to do this, but...
Well, yeah. I mean, if you only have... I would call that a linear volume, not a mirror. Because if I only have one of it, then... Yeah, if you're not mirroring and it's only one, yeah.
Oh, you have eight, but you can spread your load across.
Sure, sure. Now, there are some other... There's
two, three, you go spread across three.
There are some other caching techniques that DataCore brings to bear... inline fabric-based caching and some other pretty sophisticated stuff that I'm not going to be able to talk to you while I'm up here, although this gentleman over here can take you to the side with a whiteboard because that's a pretty complex drawing to draw out.
Is this a totally in-memory operation or is it writing stuff to the hard drive?
Nope. Pure memory. Everything runs at the speed of the memory, and I guess the other limitation would be the bus, potentially, on that host. So you're running at pure memory and fabric speed.
Remote replication, that's where the disk locally stored and then put
there. There's some journaling and some other stuff that happens with that, yeah. Yeah.
Is that the local disk within the window
unit? You've got some options in how you can do that. Yeah.
The magic question, the price point.
The price point. Please see your DataCore software, guys. I will say this, it is substantially less than any even mid-range hardware-based solution. If for no other reason than because you're buying the software. So it's kind of like ESX. You buy an ESX license, what does it cost you to build a virtual infrastructure? Well, you know, it's going to vary a little bit based on whether you're building it on 8-way boxes, 4-way boxes, 2-way boxes. There are going to be some underlying costs there that depend on the architecture. But the software piece, comparatively speaking, is significantly less.
Can you please comment on the production deployment? Like, how much have you seen, you know, this deployed for how long? You know,
DataCore's been deploying their software for like 6 years or something on that order?
8 years.
Okay, 8 years. Longer than I thought. We've been working with it extensively for the last year and done upwards of more than a dozen or so direct production employments. We're putting it today, from a cache performance perspective, in front of larger traditional arrays where we see significant fabric performance improvements using the software over and above the storage virtualization. Just pure I/O performance is significantly better.
So the write I/O is improved. Read, I don't see how read could be improved, right? Do you cache ahead or?
A lot of caching. And their cache is smart and very, very adaptive. ESX tends to work in certain ways that works very well with their caching algorithm. So you typically see significant performance improvements with ESX, particularly if you're using VMFS.
Could you start using it like just putting the box in between an existing SAN storage and your ESX, or would you have to kind of reformat everything and start from scratch?
No, you can do both. You can mix and match.
Later on also plug it out?
If you plug it out, anything that you did that was super cool based on that, obviously is going to have some interesting implications to decouple that. But as far as inserting it on the fly and leveraging it on the fly, absolutely.
Performance monitoring included with it, or is it something that's an add-on monitoring?
Base performance monitoring is included, and it's actually pretty good. They do also have more advanced performance products that are out there that give you probably way more data than you're going to want to know. They will bury you in the data.
What about reclaiming space other than destroying a one? With a 100 gig file system, if I delete a 30 gig file when it's full, I get space back.
There's actually a function in the software. It's called volume replacement. So I'm going to take your 100 gig volume, and I've written out 80 gigs. I subsequently delete 30 gigs from that, so I should have 50 gigs of free space. But because I originally wrote out 80 gigs in that model where we grab that 128 megs at a time, I've already committed that from the pool to that line. They have a mechanism in the software called volume replacement. So I can actually take that and on the back end take a fresh virtual volume and replace it up underneath that. When I resynchronize the mirror between those two, only the 50 that remains will be mirrored over, and then I can drop that, so I will effectively recoup that 30 gigs of storage back into my pool on the fly. Because that's supplanted in the virtualization layer, it doesn't actually affect the guest operating system or the host. It doesn't ever see it. It's all virtualized behind the scenes. So it's nice in the sense that one of the uses where we see this quite a bit is we'll take very large volumes, several 2 terabyte LUNs, and we'll use them for archive space. So we'll go out and we'll run a lot of disk-to-disk backups and dump into these large disk pools. As we fill that up with disk-to-disk backup space, it's burning storage allocation units out of the pool. So when we're done with the operation, seamlessly in the background, we'll do a volume replace, so it dumps it out, and now I have nothing. And I've returned all that storage every night back to my pool. So now that storage is dynamically available during the next production day cycle for actual live data. If you lost them all, the same thing that would happen if you lost your whole frame. It's no different than if you lost it in any other storage appliance. There exists the potential if you have a multi-node concurrent failure to have some data loss. Obviously, it depends on the amount of cache. If you're talking about SDSs that have 16 or 32 gigs of cache in them, which for a data core implementation would be an unbelievable amount of cache, it would be no different than if you had a SIM with that amount and you sustained a double processor or a quad processor failure.
Yeah, but to take his point further on a traditional frame, they make guarantees about, you know, whatever has been acknowledged written successfully will be destaged from the cache one way or the other, you know, even with a power outage or whatever. Is that same kind of guarantee still hold true with the SDS?
It holds absolutely true to the same extent that it does with every other manufacturer in the industry. And if you've ever experienced catastrophic frame failure, then, well, we can't talk about that in public. But the same rules will happen. What's that? Nothing is perfect. Ideally, you know, you have enough nodes, you've planned well, you have multiple mirrors. You know, yeah, I've seen implementations where you have double node failure, and we've still been able to recover. Their destage mechanism, their checking mechanism is extraordinarily robust to the point that we've done several unpleasant go-rounds with zero data loss. I have full confidence in it, I'll tell you that.
If I pull a storage on Symmetra, do I have to use ECC to allocate the lunch first and then put it under this application, or are you doing the direct management of the raw storage?
You have two options. You can do inline, or you can provision to them and have them manage it. Either way. You can do it both ways. So you can be using ECC. You can also be using whatever else. So you can be mirroring and doing all these functions simultaneously across all of them at one time.
Say you had a very unintelligent storage array, a whole bunch of them. Is there anything in this product that will stripe or span your data across?
So you're talking about using a JBOT?
Yeah, or like a JBOT or whatever.
You can connect the JBOT straight up to it.
But you have one go across multiple JBOTs. Does it handle that?
Yes and no. It depends on how stupid the JBOT is. If it's a really dumb JBOT, you can handle it through LDM and then represent it there, and then you'll layer intelligence on top of LDM in front of the JBOT. I probably wouldn't scale that out extraordinarily, because clearly there could be some performance implications related to that.
Nothing really automated in the platform that...
Yeah, it's about more likely use would be you would just use... If you're going to use straight JBODs, you'd have straight JBODs behind multiple nodes and mirror across the JBODs.
So what are the common storage, kind of mid-range storage units you deploy or recommend in your deployment?
It's
hard to see, buying a Symmetric and, putting this thing in front of it. It adds some value, but its bigger value seems to be if the back end storage is, really made cost effective rather than, some.
There's actually two stories there. One story is the one that you're hitting on, which is the mid range area. And I like any storage platform that is architecturally, fundamentally redundant in nature. I have no great love for any particular manufacturer. Now, the other story is when you talk about your high-end devices, when you're talking about a Lightning, when you're talking about a SIM, when you're talking about a Shark or something like that. The more common, and we see this quite a bit, is that I don't unfortunately have only SIMs. I may have three SIMs, but I also may have a 9800. Or I may have two 8000s, or I may have an XP series also. So what this does is it allows you to leverage the highest features and the most advanced intelligent SAN functionality across a heterogeneous high-end platform. It also allows you the functionality to inject additional caching and multi-node caching into the existing SAN infrastructure. So it's like kind of two pieces there.
Is the cache on the storage controllers themselves complicate the caching between the...
No, it's just memory. It's not cache. I'm sticking, 8 or 16 2-gig DIMMs inside that box. And obviously they're better be ECC, but I mean
like say you have a Symmetric or something like that, and it has X number of gigabytes cache, and now you have a controller sitting there, a data store with four or whatever gigabytes of cache. Is that somehow complicating?
It's not complicating, it's complementary.
Okay.
Because they're going to sit in front and more intelligently manage. They'll actually sit there and figure out the maximum rate. Kind of an interesting thing is that every vendor will give you a benchmark and say that they can deploy... They can sustain X many hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of I/O operations per second. They can sustain a maximum throughput of so many megabytes per second, and they can burst up to so much. DataCore software is intelligent enough, it'll actually figure out the actual real max that backend can actually destage at, and their buffer will be less like a bucket and more like a spring, as someone told me. And actually intelligently buffer that and cache against what the underlying storage platform is capable of handling.
So if you have mixed signal, you have memory, and you have some other off-the-wall SATA storage with a couple gigs.
I wouldn't put them in the same pool.
Okay.
I'd put them in different pools, and DataCore is going to sit there, and it'll actually figure out the maximum rate independent of each, and it will cache against that.
Do you have any support for HSM?
For HSM? Anything that you can attach to it, we'll use. They'll use it. It doesn't matter. No, no, no. It's not. Storage virtualization at this point doesn't include like higher order functionality for like ILM and that kind of thing. We're more about heterogeneity, platform independence, and the ability to get blocks on and off in the fastest and most secure, reliable way. Any other questions? No, because you don't want to target where it's going to store. It'll be targeted only to the extent that it'll go on a whatever pool you the underlying disk is assigned out of. However, I can take that and I can target that to the extent that I can have each piece of a mirror set lying on a different type of storage that will allow me to do effectively online tier migration. So I can create a disk and it may begin its life on a low-level or mid-tier storage, and then later as that server's gone through QA and test and it's ready to go into production, I can mirror that volume onto tier one storage. And as I mirror that onto tier one storage, once that mirror is synchronized, I can then replace on the backside the one side that was previously mid-tier with now also tier one storage. And I've seamlessly migrated storage tiers on the fly. You can also, you couple that with VMware and vMotion, you may have a dev or a QA environment that's running on like, you know, a little bit lower end networking like iSCSI, and then when you're ready to go into production, you vMotion onto a node that sees the same virtual LUN, but over Fibre Channel now. So now on the front end, for my path connectivity, I'm moving to tier one storage, and on the back end, I'm seamlessly moving and actually migrating to tier one storage there. So I move both pieces of the abstraction seamlessly to the client.
What's a typical deployment look like? Say you have, you know, three different arrays on the back. You kind of just carve the whole thing up into a bunch of chunks, present it to this, and then you handle all the mapping to host there? Or is there a lot of extra overhead that you now have to maintain kind of another layer of management? You have to manage each array now and carving that up and then presenting it there and then giving it to the host.
By and large, you're going to take your existing storage. I mean, there's a couple of ways to handle that, and it depends in part on what your end goal is and what you want your storage infrastructure to look like. If you're moving towards a wholly virtualized environment, then you're largely going to tend to give those your existing frames directly to, as you can, give those over directly to the DataCore software into the virtualization layer, and as you do that, you'll then begin to manage in there, and it will become a slow shell game of rotating off. Once you're done, you won't ever touch your friends again until you call to have them carried away. You'll give the whole bloody thing to them, and then you'll virtualize it all out of the gate. If I do a greenfield exercise, I'll start with somewhere between 2 and 8 nodes based on what the environment's going to look like. The appropriate number of I/O channel paths to support, you know, whatever the greenfield exercise in I/O would seem appropriate, and then I'll just build the storage directly behind them. And then as we look at host path connectivity into the virtual LUNs, I'll start to move those out and use multi mirroring and distribute that across the environment. Because right after memory, storage is the number one bottleneck in virtual infrastructure. That will stop your scalability faster than anything else. And right after that will be your Ethernet networking. CPU, no one building a new virtual infrastructure on modern computing hardware is going to be CPU bound if they're well armed when they build it. Because the stuff's just so fast and the density is so great today, you're not going to be able to burn that many CPU cycles. You'll be bound either by memory bandwidth or by storage bandwidth.
You have agreed downstairs for this price?
Yes.
What's the number?
634.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, we sell it, but it's their stuff.
Right. Okay. I'm just also in the matrix of the those STSs, and
Stuff that's a little more lengthy that we need.
I was necessarily expecting to have something like NDS 95,
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Right.
Virtualized storage.
Mm-hmm.
But
obviously there's a lot of avenues of virtualized storage. What would different vendors say?
It's a different kind of storage.
Right.
It's a hardware based. It does pretty much the same things except for caching and the ideology of having a cache and having only the necessary files to read it up on this, I'm not happy.
You're from Helsinki?
Yes. From Elisa.
Because you could probably talk to one of the data core people more in depth, but their biggest market, they almost have, I want to say, about 80% of the entire bandwidth of the entire European Union on data core. That is their biggest market, is Europe. Why that it's not here?
Hmm?
Oh, we're part. Oh, data core in Europe,
I don't know,
or data here in us?
Yeah.
Oh, we're just particular. Right, we're part